Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we focus a bit on birds and plants. We have lost 3 billion birds in the past 50 years, and 70 species have lost half or more of their breeding population. But as gardeners, you and I can help turn this around, and we have a guest that can help us in that process. Mariette Nowak is the author of the book Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region. I have it in front of me. She's an active leader and volunteer for Wild Ones, Native Plants, and Natural Landscapes. She's also a public speaker on landscaping, native plants, and birding, and is the former director of the Weir Nature Center. It's a unit of the Milwaukee County Parks in Wisconsin. So as we talk with Mariette, I hope you'll join in. Have you noticed that maybe different birds are attracted to different plants in your yard? What would you like to know about creating a bird-friendly yard? Join in. Give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. And certainly we would love to hear from you. Mariette Nowak, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Nice to talk to you today.
I've enjoyed your book very much, and we'll be zeroing in on it today. But just spend a minute or two on birds here, just to begin. We're losing a lot of birds, and in your mind, why? What are the main causes?
Well, loss of habitat, and that's where we can come in with planting plants. But there's other, threats too. Pesticides and climate change and things like that. So, yeah, we have an invasive weeds. And so there's a lot of different threats. And even in our own homes, there's threats from windows that birds don't see. They see the reflection and think they can fly right through. And there's cats that are one of our invasive species. And we should keep those indoors because cats kill a lot of birds. Millions of birds every year in our country. And so those are some of the threats to birds.
And there are tipping point species right now, aren't they? And maybe talk about tipping point.
Oh, you mean the species that are declining? Well, even some of our common birds are declining a lot. I really haven't checked exactly which species. I'd have to go into that. But we know how to help these birds. So I think if we really zero in on the birds that are declining, we can help. We can help by landscaping, but also things like the Endangered Species Act that has helped so much to restore some of our really endangered birds. And for example, the trumpeter swan was very low numbers previously, as well as the crane, the,
sandhill cranes. Yeah.
So those were helped immensely by our efforts to provide habitat for them. And but we can, for the smaller birds, we can do the same right in our own backyards.
And that's what you've done in your book. Somebody says, does the bird feeder help? Well, does it or doesn't it?
Oh, I have bird feeders, too. I kind of reduce them a little bit in the summer. But I do feel that's a great way to see the birds and to supplement them when things are not available for them in your own yard or whatever. So especially in winter, it's great for birds and can really be helpful in sustaining their populations.
Explain what you've got in your book here. It's the title, of course, is Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region, and the subtitle, The 50 Best Native Plants to Attract Birds to Your Midwest Garden. And it's full of great information, but explain how you've got it organized.
Okay, I have it organized. Not just, some books just list all the good plants for birds, but what I like always to do is to consider their habitats and the groups of birds that need particular kinds of habitats. So in my book, I have highlighted five different groups of birds and the best plants for those birds. The hummingbirds, of course, we only have one species, but that's such a beloved species. I have a whole chapter on that. And then there are goldfinches and other prairie birds that like open areas, meadows, prairies, and so forth. And we can make pocket prairies right in our backyards. And then there are birds like bluebirds and cedar waxwings that are more like savanna birds, which are birds that like a kind of an open area, but there's always a few trees. And that's what a savanna is. And then there are birds that just love shrubs, and they eat and nest and, live almost their entire lives right in shrubs. And there are woodland birds, too. And there's a variety of our trees, and there's different kinds of birds that prefer different trees oftentimes, although some trees, you know, furnish all the needs for a variety of birds.
You know, I like, and you go through the 50 plants, but one thing I like about your book a lot is for each plant, there is the plant itself, so a little description of the plant. Then it's the value of the plant to birds and other wildlife, and then how to grow that particular plant, and then, propagation of the plant, and then companion plants. And then you've got something called a closer look, which I like a lot because it's just some little side information relating to the plant and the insects that might be attracted to it or the birds that might be attracted to it. And, you have a little bit of information there just to take a little closer look at it. And I love that approach.
Oh, thank you. I liked it, too. It was fun to consider all the different unique things about the plants, for example.
Oh, we suddenly lost Mariette Nowak. But you know what? We'll get her right back. Mariette Nowak is the author of Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region. While we're getting her back, I tell you what, I'll let you know what's on next week for Garden Talk. Next week, we're going to be talking with the author of Gardening Can Be Murder, which is kind of a cool book. And then we'll take a look at caring for succulents. So that's next week on the program. And we'll take a short break. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along today. And we lost Mariette Nowak, but we've got her back. Mariette, again, the author of Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region. Great to have her back. Mariette, we lost you, but you're back. It's good to have you back.
I'm glad I'm back, too. I apologize for that. I thought I stopped call waiting, but I have a call waiting. So I'm back, though.
Okay. What were your – maybe just talk for a minute about your research sources. You have a rich selection or a rich number of resources that you used.
Yes. Okay. Well, I've used a variety of research, partly my own, my own observations and information, and also a lot of information from Doug Tallamy, a professor who has been very prominent in highlighting the need for insects for our birds. So I have a lot on insects. I think we need to love our insects. And then I have also the plants themselves. There's some online resources in regard to the documenting of the plants themselves.
So you got a lot there. You have a lot there for sure. You know, and the focus is a lot on native plants here. Why are native plants the best for birdscaping?
Well, native plants have been around with birds for millions of years, and they've developed a special interrelationship. Plants have often, sometimes even evolved in a way to accommodate the birds, because the birds then help disperse those plants, And also, the birds have sometimes adapted to special plants. For example, hummingbirds often have beaks that are just the right size for the plants they prefer. A ruby-crowned hummingbird here in our eastern North America, for example, has a beak just right for some of the flowers that it prefers. So that's kind of an exciting thing to look into. And so that's why native plants are best. They've given nourishment and cover to birds for millions of years, and our native plants do really are better sources of that than our invasive or even our cultivated plants. In a way, for example, insects cannot feed on many of the invasive or non-native plants, and so our birds, 97% of which need insects to feed their young, they do not do well if there's just cultivated plants, for example. In fact, we don't realize that by planting ornamental plants, we're really starving our birds because there's no insects for the birds. And as I said, most nestlings need insects for protein.
Yeah, I remember a reference you had to a study of chickadees. I think it took place in D.C.
Right.
Talk about that for a second.
Sure. These were urban and suburban homes in Washington, D.C., quite a number of them. I can't remember the exact number of homes. But they studied the nesting of chickadees in these properties. And the properties that had mostly cultivated and non-native plants, the chickadees actually either didn't nest, or if they did nest, their young didn't survive because they didn't have enough insects. They just didn't do well. And what was found out is that you need at least 70% of native plants in order to help chickadees survive. And we surmise that's true for most birds, that you need a lot of native plants that can provide all the nourishment that they've evolved with, you know, that they've prospered with through the millions of years.
Yeah. Mariette Nowak, our guest as we talk birdscaping for Wisconsin. We're going to get into the plants that she features. She features 50 plants in her book and talk about growing them and successfully and which birds and insects are attracted to these specific plants. And you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on nativars? Are probably we shouldn't be planting all nativars.
That's right. Nativars are the cultivated versions of native plants. They've done something different for those plants that make them less oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes less good for birds. Sometimes they don't even form seeds, for example, or the colors are different and that changes the chemistry, so the insects that birds need cannot feed on them. So generally, cultivars are not recommended at all. I mean, there's some that might be good, but we can never study all of those and, all the, hundreds of plants. We can't study. There's not enough. There's not enough people to do all that research. The best thing is just to stick with natives that have been around all this time and nourish birds, as I said, through the millions of years.
Phil in Mount Horeb has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I have been running a bluebird string for over 30 years, and I was in Connecticut when I took a course, a short course from Dr. David Hill, who was affiliated with Yale, and he was a bluebird enthusiast, and he said, and I think that this is important for all people who want to cite bluebird boxes, that you should have some kind of perch within 30 feet of the front of the box, so that the fledglings, who have never flown before and are heavy and plump compared to their wing size, could make it out without falling into the grass and then never getting out, of course. I have preached this to many people over the years, including to members of a prominent bluebird organization here in Wisconsin, and I have gotten a lukewarm response, and it confuses me because the logic about a heavy little never-flown bird trying to make it out in life, it's difficult enough for all of us to do that, but especially for a little bird like that. So I wanted to get your guess. A comment on that, if that's a current thought stream in the birding bluebird community, and how we can encourage more people to sight either a tee or to sight a tee to allow the birds to fly to a perch, or to sight the box near a shrub or tree that they can alight on.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. In my first book, I believe I even addressed that because, yes, you're right. And in my own yard, I do have a bluebird box that is, you know, like you said, about, I don't know how many yards. I'm not good at measurements. But, yes, they can fly to that tree and perch as when they're nestlings. That's absolutely correct, and I'm glad that you're educating everyone about that.
Phil, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Well, it sort of brings up the whole business of the kinds of features we should be providing, plant features that we should be providing for birds to come to our garden.
Yes, definitely. Of course, you know, with hummingbirds, you want to plant plants that have the shape and so forth that invite hummingbirds. And sometimes those same plants will kind of deter insects competition for those plants. So, yeah, I have in my book a number of the features of a hummingbird plant. They're tubular. They often don't have a landing pad because the insects need that, where hummingbirds are great for hovering and so forth. So yes, that's important. And then, you know, it's a prairie plant. A lot of the composites, the open sunflower-like plants are great for those birds because they provide insects and sometimes even nectar for the birds. So yeah, and then seeds, that's even more important in the later in the summer and so forth. A lot of those goldfinches and other finches and prairie birds need a lot of seeds. So the prairie plants that I highlight specialize in that. And so and then some birds like birds and others like a lot of fruit too. I mean, although they eat insects, bluebirds also need a lot of berries as well as insects. So, yeah, so it definitely you have to have the right plants for the right birds is really important if you want to have certain species or if you want to have a variety. I mean, a lot of people might have a little shrubby corner and a little open pocket prairies, so forth, in their own backyard. So, yeah, you can have a variety like that, and then you'll have more variety in the birds that you attract and nourish.
Yeah. Seeds or plants? Do you use both a combination of seeds and plants when you're putting something like this together?
Well, plants that provide seeds, yes. In each case, what I'm trying to do in each of those five groups of birds, I'm trying to furnish all the different nourishment needs that they might have. For example, some birds shrubland birds like a lot of berries, but they also need some. They also need insects and so forth. And so we try to. I'm trying in each case to provide all the kinds of food that particular group of birds, whether they're prairie birds or shrubland birds or woodland birds, all the kinds that they might need throughout their life cycle.
Let's take a look and zero in a bit on some of the plants and kind of by area maybe. And you started with the ruby-throated hummingbirds. And you list 10 plants that you like for them. One of them is wild columbine.
Right. That's our first main native plant that provides nectar for the hummingbirds. And oftentimes, ornithologists have watched and observed that they follow the blossoming of the columbine as they go north. So that's a great one for the beginning of the year. And then I have jewelweed blossoms later in the year, and that sort of frames the year because the hummingbirds often feed on that as the last plant to blossom in our area, and they follow that as they go south in the fall of the year. And then all the others that I have there provide throughout the season, different times that they'll provide nectar for the hummingbirds.
What about, let's take wild columbine for a minute, any particular problems with growing it, or is it sun, shade? What do you think?
Okay, that's a wonderful plant to grow, and sometimes it wants to jump around. I know in my yard I planted it several places, and then it shows up in other parts of the yard. So that's it's kind of like, I think it definitely doesn't like a lot of competition. And partial shade to shade. It grows well in that. It's not too fussy about the soil. It likes dry to moist soil. So you'll find it in the woodland areas and kind of semi-open areas. So it's a great plant to grow, and it's very common through many states. And as far as that goes, it's really a great overall plant for the hummingbirds, and it has a great shape. The tubes or spurs of this columbine actually evolved to the perfect length for the bill of the ruby-throated hummingbird. And spurs contain the nectar. Sometimes if you look closely,
you can see the nectar itself, I'm guessing here. Oh, my gosh. We had a little problem again with our guest, Marianne Nowak, our guest today, and we've lost her again. So we'll get her back, and in the meantime, I'll let you know a couple of other things that are coming up on the show. Just take a look at Monday. We're going to take a look at some health-related things on Monday. We've got an increase in alcohol-related liver disease. We'll be talking about that. We're going to be talking about a new UW-Madison certificate program on aging. We'll get into that as well. And then on Monday, we'll wrap up the show with the Weather Guys. The Weather Guys will be with us for the entire show. And we're going to take another quick break. We'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on Garden Talk. For WPR News, Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the book Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region with our guest, Mariette Nowak. It's great to have her with us. She's the author of the book, and it contains the 50 best native plants to attract birds to your Midwestern garden. So great to have her with us. Mariette, are you back? Are you with us again?
I apologize for that. Yeah,
oh, okay.
You.
Well, we have Gianni in Montello is with us and has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Gianni.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Larry. Yeah, we put in a hummingbird feeder out. I picked one up at the local Dollar General. It's plastic, and this is the first year that I've used a plastic hummingbird feeder, and ratio of 4 to 1, four parts water, one part sugar, and they didn't go into it, and I'm wondering why. And my second question is, when should we remove the hummingbird syrup or the feeder in September? Because, you know, we want to encourage the birds to go south. They don't want to get caught here in an ice storm in October. So if you could address those two questions.
Sure. thanks for asking. I have a plastic feeder, and I have never had any problem. Sometimes if the birds in the beginning don't come, you might want to try a stronger solution, a more sugary solution. So I would suggest adding a little sugar. And I don't know if you have it in the same place as your last one. I'm hoping that the hummingbirds are doing well. It could be that they just aren't coming this year. I mean, some people do have a little trouble getting hummingbirds to come, especially if you're in an urban area or even sometimes a suburban area. When I lived in the Milwaukee area, I only got hummingbirds during migration, not during the summer. Now, in regard to your other question, what was that again?
It had to do with feeding in the fall.
Right. In the fall of the year, it is now believed that you should keep up those feeders as long as you want because the hummingbirds will leave when they're ready. And oftentimes, sometimes when you have those feeders up longer, you might get a few stray western species like the rufous. Rufous hummingbird sometimes comes to our area even late in the season. So, as I said, just keep it up as long as you want, but just make sure you clean it regularly. That's one of the most important things about hummingbird feeders in the summer. You should be cleaning that every 3 days. So that might be another thing to look at. I remember going to a friend's house, and it was all those little ports were moldy. So you really want to make sure you clean that every 3 days during the summer.
All right. Gianni, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in to 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Ray in Cable emailed to ask what to do in her. She's got a shady northwest Wisconsin yard, Cable. That's way up there. Mostly maple and oak and some pine, and she lives on lakeshore property. And what could she do to add bird magnets to her yard through plants?
Okay, well, trees are plants, so those are great trees to have. And in my book, I just discussed some of the plants that you could add under trees oftentimes. And I'd have to check on that, but for oaks, there's a lot of variety of plants that you could add under oaks. And I really have to check on exactly what would be the best. There's such a variety, it's hard to even zero in on that. But there's, in the northern area, you might have, some of the, I'm trying to think of some of those really new, even orchids, you have more orchids up there. And I'm down in southern Wisconsin, so I'm not quite, I don't have all those plants on my fingertips, but there's many great plants, almost everything that's there. And then as far as pines, sometimes pines are a little too shady, so you might not have as much variety under there. And but there are some that plants. And what was the third tree you said? Pines and maples.
Oak and some pine. Yeah.
Well, maple would be. Maples can be hard to plant under because they're so shady, especially the sugar maple. And so in that case, just make sure you have lots of leaf litter. The birds love leaf litter. They need a soft landing. And it's been found that almost 94% of the caterpillars that are tree caterpillars fall down after they've been eating the leaves during the summer. And then they find refuge and sustenance down in the leaves. That's where they'll stay for the late fall and winter. So that's a good way to make sure you have the caterpillars that birds need. And I'm afraid that I'm not quite up to date on some of those best plants for way up north like that. But there's a great number of plants that you can find in various sources. The sugar maple certainly has a wonderful color, so you should be very thrilled up there. And I'm hoping that they do well there because they talk about with climate change, we're going to be losing them down here in the southern Wisconsin. So enjoy them and some of the other plants might be. Like blueberries are great for birds, that you might grow better up there because the soil is acidic. So that's one of the ones I would suggest. And so let me look at my list here as far as this. I'll have to check on that, but a lot of the grasses, too, there's the grasses that love that grow well in woodlands, and some of those might be bottle brush grass is a good one, and some of the others would be, let's see, I'm trying to think of some other grasses. Oh, like the tan sedge, some of the sedges do well in woodlands. So you have some grasses as well as wildflowers, but I think of any of the northern ones right now, other than those.
Let's take a call from Shirley in Marengo next. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's regarding the hummingbirds. Around, I think it was year 2021, we had an excessive amount of hummingbirds. We were going through 5 feeders, sometimes twice a day. And Great Gardening from Duluth came in, filmed the gardens and the hummingbirds. And ever since then, it's been declining every year. Now we only have a couple, and I have a lot of gardens. And I was just wondering if there's a decline in hummingbirds or if they just don't always return to the same place.
Well, hummingbirds usually come to the same place, but, of course, they don't live forever. So maybe the hummingbirds that came previously have passed away. And, of course, that addresses the fact that we've lost 3 billion birds over the last 50 years. So that's just a sign of that again. And as far as hummingbirds, think of all the migration that they have across the southern United States, where there have been so many terrible storms and so forth. And I believe climate change is a big factor in the reduced number of birds within the last few years, particularly, and talked about the hummingbirds. And that's very sad to hear about that. So hope it changes and keep up the good work then. Hopefully they'll – by the way, people here have not noticed that so much. So I don't know if it's something up where you live or if they just don't get that far in their migration. I'm sorry to hear that, though, and let's hope it changes as we all work hard to, address climate change on our local levels by planting native, and also hopefully soon it'll get better on the national scene.
Yeah. Shirley, thanks for calling. I was thinking back to the plants that you were recommending. And the time of the planting blooming, of the plants blooming, and you did talk about wild columbine because they are early flowering, and you talked about the setting and where it fits best in a landscape. But you also mentioned orange jewelweed. Orange jewelweed is a later blooming plant and one of the latest blooming plants, and it may be useful to have both plants in the same yard. Would you plant orange jewelweed near the wild columbine, or would orange jewelweed require more light?
Orange jewelweed generally grows in lighter areas too. But they do like a little more moist soil. So I have them both in my yard. I have both species in my yard, but the one is near a little orange jewelweed is more in the damp areas. I have a little kettle, and they surround the kettle like a ring of flowers, which is quite lovely. But the jewelweed grows on drier soil near my home, near the house. So, yes, you can grow both, but you might need a slightly different soil or, moisture. And another thing you could do, if you have a little bird bath and it drips over the edge, you could plant some of the plants that you couldn't plant under that, or a sump pump. I've often in my past home, I had a sump pump the soil got very moist in there, and I grew plants there that I couldn't grow in the rest of the yard because it was more moist. So use the water that falls on your property if you have damp spots or if you have a sump pump or a little bird bath that drips over. Those are great places to plant those species that need a little bit more moisture.
And another one of the plants you mentioned, which intrigued me a bit, was pussy willow for attracting ruby-throated hummingbirds. And I'm wondering, what does the pussy willow plant, because that's a plant that's pretty easy to grow, I think.
It is, but it does need a little bit of moist soil, too. That can't be a real dry area, but yes. That is pretty easy to grow, and it's really wonderful in many ways. But for the hummingbirds, it also has very small insects early on that are good for the hummingbirds, and then the little fluff can be used when they're nesting. They use that in their nest material. But willow is great for many other insects, too, that birds depend on.
So it's not the nectar, it's the insects that they attract that make pussy willow attractive. That's interesting. Blazing star. Yeah. You mentioned blazing star too as one of the 10 for hummingbirds. And talk a bit about blazing star or gray feather, or gay feather,
oh, yeah.
I should say.
Oh, yeah, it's a wonderful plant, and it's one of our most beautiful plants for either for the hummingbird, but as well as for prairies and. People just love it, and there's about 5 different species that I highlight, and different species can do better in different areas. Some like it a little more damp soil, some do well in very dry soil, and it has a good, the tubes for the birds and so forth. Not only that, but one of them, I was thinking of something else that's like, it also has a very fascinating mechanism in its plants in that the flowers have 2 different stages, the male stage and the female stage. And, of course, oftentimes plants have that situation, and that prevents self-pollination. So the part of the flower that's the male flower part will ripen first, oftentimes in blazing star, blazing star, they're purple-colored anthers when the male stage is ripe. And when the female is ripe, those anthers turn a tan color. Just sometimes the insects can pick up on that, and they'll know when there is nectar in the plants or when the pollen is best. So that's kind of a fascinating thing also.
Yeah.
So anyway, the interesting things about these plants, and that's what I try to highlight too when I discuss them.
Yeah, I think the plants that you have in that list of top 10 for ruby-throated hummingbirds is, in my mind, a great plant list because every one of those plants will do okay in Wisconsin, depending on shade and water and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
But they're really good selections. The one that I kind of enjoyed as well was the section on plants for goldfinches and other prairie birds. We don't often think about thistle, but the native thistle can be excellent for those birds.
Oh, definitely. And, yeah, I have a few plants that people might find a little controversial, and thistles are one of them. But I think I quote Xerxes, that organization that is trying to promote our invertebrates, like insects and so forth, and native thistles are so great for them, too. And I found not only are they great for goldfinches, they're great for insects, too. But goldfinches particularly have a relationship with thistles. They're one of the few birds that feed only insects, only seeds to their nestlings. So they nest later than most birds, and they kind of wait for thistles to start to blossom and provide seed for their nestlings. They also use that thistle down for their nests. So they have a very special relationship, goldfinches and thistles. And not only that, thistles are great for butterflies. I've seen like 3 butterflies on 1 native thistle. And they're very beautiful, too. If you take a look at the 2 native ones I highlight, one is for wet areas and one is for dry areas. And I have this dry one called a prairie thistle or field thistle, and it really attracts many insects. So I really highly recommend that, as well as this Xerxes organization does. So that's one of that's a little controversial. And you might also find in my for the shrubland birds, I mention brambles like raspberries and blackberries. A lot of people really dislike those, if in their yards or in prairies, because they're kind of, well, they're brambles. They ramble around. They're kind of rather aggressive at times, but they are great for birds. They're just wonderful. So anyway, I really highly recommend those 2 species, even though they're a little unusual.
Yeah. A couple of plants that I have, and we're going to find all over the Wisconsin, I think, are the purple coneflowers and the yellow coneflowers, and they are good for goldfinches and other prairie birds.
Oh, they're wonderful. The purple coneflower is probably the plant that the wildflower that really got native flowers on the scene. Purple coneflowers are so beautiful, and the seeds are so great for goldfinches and other finches. And besides that, the flowers are gorgeous. They attract a lot of insects, and I think they're a highlight for any yard. And there's 2 different species, by the way, too. There's one that's just called the purple coneflower and one that's called the pale purple coneflower. You also mentioned the yellow coneflower. So there's 3 coneflowers there, although the yellow coneflower is a different genus. But anyway, they're all wonderful and easy to grow and wonderful for birds and insects and butterflies.
You're telling me, I'm going to go back to oaks for a minute because I was thinking about goldfinches. And at one point in the book, you tell a fun story about goldfinches relating to your red oak tree. And you bring in Phil Pelletieri.
Right.
Who has often been a guest on the show. So tell that story about the goldfinches and what they were doing.
Okay, that was very interesting. Yes, they usually devoured seeds at my feeders or on the seed heads in my prairie plants. But one fall, I saw them foraging busily among the leaves of a red oak. And I was wondering, what were they doing? Some of the leaves were completely brown and crisp. Others were still green, but all were loaded with little, small, round bumps, as many as 9 or more per leaf. And I asked Phil Pelletieri to identify them, and he said they were formed by cnipid gall wasps. These are wasps that planted the little eggs on the leaves, and the leaves then formed a little ball around them, a little gall. And so there's at least 10 species of these kinds of gall wasps that can form these little galls on red oak leaves. And the finches were probing the galls and feasting on the protein-packed insects within. And so it was a great eye-opener to me, and it shows how valuable even galls were. Insect-formed galls are on some of our plants.
I thought it was pretty cool. And just a reminder again, Doug Tallamy has often talked about the value of an oak tree and the many species of insects and birds and wildlife in general that thrive under and within and on an oak tree. So it was a pretty cool story to see Phil get a mention in there, too. Kelsey in Madison emailed, is there a way to approach bird-friendly plantings that encourages native Wisconsin birds and also deters pest species like house sparrows? She has so many house sparrows in her neighborhood, and it feels every time she tries to encourage birds in her yard, she just gets more of them instead.
Oh, well, that's too bad. Well, I actually don't think there's any plant that will deter house sparrows, I'm afraid to say, but I sympathize with that. And if you have bird houses, there are traps and different measures that you can do to keep the house sparrows out of your nest boxes. So they must be nesting around, and I guess one thought would be just to try to make sure that they're not in the nest boxes that you might put up. But I'm afraid to say I have no, I don't think there's any plant that will deter them.
I have the same issue with my my own feeders, and especially they tend to get covered with house sparrows, and to the detriment of the other birds that a lot of times want to try and get in there to feed, but they get kicked out by the sparrows.
Oh, that's too bad. I'm lucky not to have that problem here.
Well, your book, how's your book doing?
Well, I don't know because it was just out. But I've gotten good reviews of it, and the photographers who I sent the book to or gave the book to, they appreciate it, and I'm thrilled with all the wonderful photos that they offered in the book. I have wonderful photos, as you know, of many births, and that's what I've highlighted, the relationship, that intriguing relationship between birds and plants, and how they both have evolved together and nourish one another in a sense. So, yeah.
I like that you even at the end added in an appendix the top wetland and rain garden plants for birds, which
right.
We have a lot of people here interested in rain gardens. So the herbaceous species, you talk about those. You talk about the shrubs that work well in wetland and rain garden situations, and even the trees.
Right, right. Yeah, and the trees, there's some birds that have special relationships with those trees. As I said, the pine warbler loves the pines, and the red poles love birches, and so forth. So there's, if there are cherries with those tent caterpillars, the cuckoos love those. Last year, there were a lot of caterpillars, especially even the spongy moth caterpillars, and I heard cuckoos every day. This year, there's no spongy caterpillars in my yard or in the neighborhood, so I've only heard cuckoos twice. But it just shows how that the cuckoos had zeroed in and helped us at least in some, not enough, I don't think we need more cuckoos to really those spongy moths, but it was very interesting to note that difference.
Yeah, it is. And your book's interesting for sure, Mariette, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, and appreciate the book very much. The title is, it's great to have you with us. Birdscaping for Wisconsin and the Great Lakes Region is the title. The subtitle is The 50 Best Native Plants to Attract Birds to Your Midwest Garden. Mariette Nowak, our guest. Fun having her with us today. Coming up, we're going to take a look at plants and plant diseases with our guest, Brian Huddleston. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to plant diseases. You know, every year it's a little different. There are some that come every year, and then there are others that come and go depending on the weather. And I want to find out what's going on this year. And who better to talk about it than Brian Huddleston, Dr. Death. He is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, resides within the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What plant disease questions are on your mind or in your garden? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Brian Huddleston, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me again.
You know, there's a fungus that I think is so aptly named. It's called the dead man's fingers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think it's a perfect description of that fungus. But talk about it, and you're seeing a bit more of it this year, as I understand.
Yeah, I've had an inordinate number of questions about dead man's fingers this spring. I occasionally got questions in the past, but this year it seems to be fruiting like crazy. It's a fungus, and the fruiting bodies, basically the mushroom-like part of this fungus, look like fingers. Or I've seen one example, probably the best photo, is where there are five of them coming up underneath from a log, and it looks like five toes of that's been crushed by a log. But they're relatively dark in color, kind of darkish blue to black, oftentimes with a little bit of a gray sort of tip. And they're a spore-producing structure of a fungus. There are several different species. The one I'm most interested in is one called, it's Xylaria is the genus, but Xylaria polymorpha, which is an actual pathogen. It can cause disease. It tends to be a stress-related pathogen, so it's more likely to infect plants that have been under some sort of stress. And I'm wondering, and this is just speculation, but I'm wondering, because we had that really bad drought in 2023, whether that kind of predisposed plants to become infected by this particular fungus. And then we've had a couple of springs, both last year and this year, where we've had a lot of rain, which would tend to stimulate production of the reproductive structures, which are these little blackish fingers that pop up. But the queries I've had, one person in particular had a dog that seemed to like to rummage around and try to eat them, and not necessarily a good thing, because those mushroom-like structures can have some toxins in them that can be toxic to animals and humans as well if you would try to eat them.
Yeah. You wrote a limerick about them in your book, didn't you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there is one in there. I don't remember it off the top of my head, but yes, there is a dead man's fingers, something about zinger. That was one of the zingers is one of the rhymes in that particular limerick, as I recall. So, yeah.
And well, just to get off, you're working on another book too, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm working on a follow-up to my first limerick book. And the first one was kind of on just different types of plant diseases. And the second one is more limericks describing plant disease management. So I'm about halfway done with the writing and the artwork for that. I think I finished up limerick number 26. I'd like to have another 52 in that book. That may take me a little while to finish, but it is summer now, so it's gotten beyond the point where I can actually work on that. It's time to work on samples in the clinic.
Yeah. Ann in Appleton has a question for you relating to something. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Yes, hi. I have peach leaf curl on my peach trees, and I would like to maintain an organic or safe garden. And what could I do and when to treat this?
And maybe you should explain it first, Brian, what it is.
Yeah, peach leaf curl is another fungal disease. It has been absolutely off the scale this year. I haven't seen a year this bad for that particular disease in a long time. Again, it's fungal in nature. The fungus overwinters typically on branches or in the scales of the buds that are waiting around to sprout the following growing season. And once those leaves start to come out, the fungus produces spores that infect. And then you get this kind of seersucker sort of pattern to the leaves. They get very curly and very puckered. Instead of being solid green, it's quite a colorful disease because these infected areas can be kind of reddish or pinkish or kind of salmony or whitish, creamy white. And it can cause a lot of growth distortions when it's really severe. And I've been seeing this year. It can cause some of the leaves to fall off the trees. The thing of it is, once you start seeing all these symptoms, there's nothing you can do about it. It's too late. And you really have to deal with it after the trees have defoliated in the fall. And the recommendation are some fungicide sprays. Since the caller was specifically interested in more organic sorts of treatments, the active ingredients that I would recommend for control with these sprays would be copper. So you need a copper-containing fungicide that's labeled for use on edible fruit crops. Not all copper-containing materials will be labeled for edible plants. Some are for ornamentals only. So that's one caveat if you want to use spray treatments. And you make a treatment to the branches and the buds of the tree. You can do that in the fall. You can also wait until the spring just before the new leaf buds start to swell and do a treatment then. And that should help control it. Sometimes when the disease is super severe, I'll actually recommend that people do both a fall treatment and a spring treatment just to kind of to try to knock back this fungus. There's also a variation of this disease that occurs on plums, but it's a slightly different species of the fungus than the one that causes peach leaf curl. It causes a disease called plum pockets, and that variant of the fungus only infects the fruits of the plum trees. So if you ever have a plum where you get these really large and spongy kind of hollow fruits, that's the kind of the peach leaf curl variant on plums. Again, it's called plum pockets. And if you want to read more about this, I have a fact sheet on this disease on my clinic website. And that's pddc.wisc.edu. Other things to keep in mind if you're having problems with this disease this year, and particularly if you're getting a lot of leaf loss, would be to make sure you're giving the trees enough water, about an inch of water per week. You want to reduce the stress in the trees as they're losing those leaves. You may want to give the trees a little bit of a shot of nitrogen, but make sure you don't do that too late in the growing season, not after about August 1st. If you apply nitrogen late in the growing season, it tends to keep trees from going dormant properly, and then you can end up with winter injury. And we've already seen a lot of winter injury from this past winter anyway, so you don't want to contribute to that by fertilizing at the wrong time.
I was wondering about cleaning up in the fall. If you have like a peach leaf curl, is it good to get rid of those leaves and everything around it?
For that specific disease, it doesn't make any difference because that's not where the fungus is hanging out over the winter. It's on the branches. But
okay.
For most leaf diseases that I deal with, yes, doing good cleanup of that infected leaf debris that's on the ground is a good thing to try to do. Sometimes people don't want to do that in the fall because they want to keep that debris there as an overwintering site for beneficial insects. But if you don't do it then, you really need to get out in the spring before the trees leaf out and get rid of that material, because otherwise there are going to be spores generated in that leaf litter that are going to reinfect your trees. And one of the diseases that I'm starting to see a fair number of samples come in where leaf cleanup is important is apple scab. If you've got an apple or a crab apple tree that's starting to defoliate, then that's probably the disease that you're dealing with. And that fungus hangs out in leaf litter on the ground.
And I want to go back. By the way, Brian's here to answer your questions. So if you have one, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Or email to talk at WPR.org. I wanted to go back to dead man's fingers for just a second.
Sure.
Because I'm not sure, should we be concerned if we spot it in the garden, I guess is the question.
I wouldn't be overly concerned if you see this. It could be causing some problems in some of your trees and shrubs. Again, if they've been stressed, it's more likely colonizing the root system and causing some damage. Unfortunately, once it's infected, there's not anything you can really do about it. If you have animals that are curious about these fingers, I would remove them and get rid of them so that the dogs don't eat them, because you don't want them to get, you know, the toxins from those structures. But other than that, I kind of think they're cool looking. And again, there's not much you can do about it in terms of them being pathogens. The infections have already occurred, and they've got a ready food source at that point. Otherwise, they wouldn't be producing the fingers, because, again, that's a reproductive structure. But I just kind of enjoy them when I see them, because I think they look quite cool.
Yeah, they're pretty cool. Jane emailed one branch near the ground on one of her lilac bushes has leaves that are curled and folded in. The rest of the leaves on the bush look normal. And so these are near the ground. What could be causing this?
I would be concerned. It depends on whether the leaves are green or brown. If they're green and kind of folded, if you happen to have, say, a lawn care service or it applied some sort of weed and feed product to your lawn near the shrubs, those products contain herbicides. And if you had a little bit of drift to those lower branches, you might see some folding of the leaves. The other thing I would look for if there were herbicide issues would be kind of a curlicuing of the petioles, of stems on the leaves. It's a typical symptom that we'll see. If you're starting to see kind of abnormal growth in the leaves and you see a lot of browning associated with it, you could be seeing the start of a fungal disease called septorial leaf spot that we have seen the last, we saw a lot of it last year, not so much in 2023 because it was too dry. But last year we saw a lot of that disease, but that will cause browning on the leaves.
Brian Huddleston, our guest today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. He's our guest. And again, join him, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at plant diseases with our guest, Brian Huddleston. Great to have him back. Just a quick mention, next week on Garden Talk, we'll visit with the author of Gardening Can Be Murder and then look at caring for succulents. But right now, zeroing in on plants and plant diseases with Brian. And you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go back to apple scab for a minute or two, Brian. How typically is it loss of leaves that's the identifying feature?
You can see symptoms before you start to see that leaf loss, but oftentimes people start to notice scab when the leaves start to drop off the trees. But what I would look for would be, at least initially, some spotting on the leaves. It'll be kind of diffuse and dark in color, and oftentimes you'll have patches of that across the leaves. Oftentimes you'll get yellowing of the leaves as well. And I have seen some examples where the leaves are yellow, but you don't see any obvious indication of the fungus on those leaves. I have to look at it microscopically. I take a piece of tape and plastered onto the leaf and peel it off, and then I look for spores of the fungus. And then eventually, as the disease progresses, then that's when you get the loss of leaves. And the trees, if it's a susceptible variety, they can totally defoliate by roughly mid-season. So as we get into July, you'll see a large number of crab apples that don't have any leaves on them, and those are the susceptible varieties.
Are there some good varieties that are really not susceptible to it?
There are. I don't know the names of them off the top of my head. What I normally tell people to do is look around in their neighborhood for trees that are maintaining their leaves late into the growing season, and then check with their neighbors to see which variety it is, and then go to your local garden center or nursery and select a different variety from what your neighbors has, but that's rated at the nursery for having scab resistance. And the reason I say that is there was one variety that was introduced probably about 20 years ago called Prairie Fire.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful crabapple tree, beautiful blossom, very profuse bloomer, and had been bred for resistance to apple scab. And it was such a beautiful tree and apple scab resistance, everybody was looking for that. everybody planted that particular variety. And what happened is we set up a little scientific experiment where we started to select for variants of the apple scab fungus that could overcome that resistance. So now if you look at prairie fire nowadays, it doesn't look that resistant to scab. So in my mind, you want to kind of diversify which varieties you have out there that have resistance to scab. Try to deploy different genetics in the different varieties so that you kind of prevent that resistance development from occurring. So we see this very often when we get varieties that are super popular and they have disease resistance. Oftentimes, eventually, that resistance fails.
Mike in Wausau has a question or comment, I believe. Let's go there. Mike, hi.
Hi. I've noticed in my yard and just walking around the neighborhood, we have a lot of healthy-looking maple leaves that have just fallen. I'm wondering if that's disease-related or if that's just, like, weather-related?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that could be going on, and neither of them is really disease-related. What I would do if you see those, I'm assuming the leaves are nice and green. If that's the case, then I would check the petioles, those stems on the leaves, to see whether they look like they're the full length or whether they've been clipped off. If they've been clipped off, there's an insect pest. Maple petiole borer, I believe, is the name of the insect that will come in and will kind of clip those leaves off. Sometimes what we see in trees, not so much in maples, I see this phenomenon more commonly on ash trees, is that we get a loss of green leaves, usually around the end of May, early June. And people have looked at this in ash trees over the years to see whether there's an insect or a disease that's causing this premature, basically healthy leaf loss. Nobody's been able to find anything. And kind of the general thought is that the trees overproduce leaves and then they compensate by dropping a few of them as we get farther into the growing season, leaves that really aren't being that efficient in terms of photosynthesizing for the trees. There was one other thing I was going to mention, and now it's flown out of my head, but I'll think of it in a bit. Oh, the other thing, if I would also take a look at whether it's individual leaves, are you seeing little branch tips with several leaves on them that have fallen off? If you're seeing that with branches, it could be squirrel activity. And yeah. We see squirrels that'll get into the trees and they'll nip off the ends of the branches, and then you'll get a cluster of leaves that'll come off the trees. Now, I've seen that in maples as well. We had an example of that coming to the clinic this spring.
Mike, thank you for calling. Brenda in Richland Center will give you a chance. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So we have three paper white birches in our yard, and a couple of years ago, one of them, something got it. I don't know. It would go like a whole branch would die and then the next branch. So we cut it off. We cut it down, and now it's on another one. And I don't know what to do with it. What do you think it is? And will it get to our maple trees, too?
Yeah, if you saw that on maples, I would have a disease cause for you. On birch trees, though, I think more likely it could be an insect problem again.
Bronze birch borer,
bronze
maybe.
Bronze birch borer, yeah, is my first thought. Yeah. If the branches are dying back, I'd be more inclined to think bronze birch borer. That particular insect tends to attack stressed birch trees. And if you happen to have those trees in full sun, or in an area where they're getting a lot of water stress, then that's attractive to those insects, and they will come in and they tend to cause the branches, sections of the tree to die. Now, if you started to see that sort of symptomology on a maple or on other types of trees, ash trees, magnolia trees, if you grow red buds, red bud trees, tree lilacs or even shrub lilacs, kind of a sectional dieback of the tree, then there's a disease called verticillium wilt. It's fungal again. The fungus, it's called verticillium, hangs out in the soil and infects through the root system, colonizes the water conducting tissue, and blocks it off. So it prevents water movement from the roots up into the branches, and that will lead to a wilting and dieback. And that disease tends to be fatal. Once the trees are infected, eventually they will become totally infected and everything will die. And then you have to be a bit careful about what you replant in that area, because the fungus will hang around in the soil for an extended period of time.
Brenda, does that help?
Well, if it's the birch borer, how do we treat that?
Yeah, that would be a question for my compatriot in the entomology department, PJ Leash. He's my counterpart, does insect diagnostics, and I would give him a shout. His email is pleash, so pleesch at wisc.edu. And he may want to see some photos or perhaps some branches in order to actually look for evidence of the insect before he makes any sort of recommendation. But again, if you have those trees sited in a less than optimal area in your yard and they're under a lot of stress all the time, there may not be a lot you can do. It's that inappropriate placement when they're planted that oftentimes is the issue. So you want to give birches a bit of shade and cooler area and make sure they're getting plenty of water. To keep them well hydrated so they don't go under water stress.
Yeah, paper birch are notoriously planted in...
Finicky.
Yeah, they're finicky, and then if they get planted someplace where...
Right. They're beautiful trees, so everybody wants them out where everybody can see them, and that tends to be in the middle of the yard where it's hot and dry with grass growing all the way up to the base, so they're getting starved for water because the grass is sopping up all the moisture, and they just don't do well in that environment.
You described the paper birch that I had two houses ago to a T.
They're beautiful trees, I can understand. The other tree where I see this happen is a pagoda dogwood, which is really an understory tree. It likes a lot of shade, cooler conditions, relatively moist soils. And again, it's got this beautiful horizontal branch structure that makes it look really pretty. It looks like it has layers in the trees, and it's such a, and it blooms as well, has these clusters of white flowers, and it's a very pretty tree. So everybody wants to show it off. And again, it ends up in the middle of the yard with grass around it under it, totally inappropriate environmental conditions. And then it gets stressed and becomes susceptible to a disease called golden canker. So if you've got a pagoda dogwood and you start to see the branches on that tree die back and they're kind of a gold color, oftentimes with little orange spots, you're dealing with this golden canker disease.
Brenda, thank you so much for calling. Marianne in the Twin Cities, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question about a columbine, because I've been, over the last 3 years, trying to increase the number of perennials, and I have a blue columbine that I planted last year. And it came up this spring, had beautiful, beautiful flowers. And, of course, you know, it's early, so now it's full of seed pods. But over the course of a week that I was gone, all the leaves are gone.
Yeah,
that's just like little stick fingers. Now, is that a disease or is that an insect? And is the plant dead?
That's an insect problem. And that, from what I understand, won't kill the plant. If it would defoliate from this insect year after year after year, then it will probably get stressed to the point where it won't survive. If it only happens a single year, then I'm less worried about that. Again, I don't know enough details on that particular insect to provide you with good information on management. That would be another question for PJ, my counterpart in the insect world. But I've seen that. The other thing I see commonly on columbine is leaf miner. So if you have intact leaves, but you see all of these little trails in the leaves, that's another type of insect that can cause problems. I think the one that chews off the leaves, that may be a larva of a sawfly of some kind. Don't quote me on that, but that's my recollection from when I've heard PJ talk about that.
Yeah, and again, the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you can get to PJ through that as well, and he can help you, may be able to help you out even more.
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah.
So definitely contact him if you have questions about insect-related things.
You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Mary in Eau Claire emailed, just wanted to compliment you on your fun book on plant diseases, Limerickettsia. Well-written, fun poems, artwork, great, and very informative. So there you go, from Mary in Eau Claire.
Yeah, we sell that as a fundraiser for the clinic. So if you're interested in taking a look, there's some sample pages on my clinic website, and there's an order form there if you'd like to order a copy.
Yeah, it's a cool book. Mel emailed, his 20-year-old serviceberry recently died with fungus on the bark. His new serviceberry was just planted. Should he spray the new Regent serviceberry with the dormant oil in the early spring? Is Zeme oil okay?
Yeah, without knowing exactly what the problem is, I doubt whether dormant oil would, if you actually had a disease issue, and it sounds like there may have been some winter injury and maybe a fungal colonization of the trunk of that old serviceberry. That's my first thought, because serviceberry in my mind is pretty not prone diseases. I recommend serviceberry a lot because it doesn't tend to get a lot of diseases. But dormant oils really typically are not particularly useful for plant diseases. That tends to be more of a treatment that you would use for certain types of insects. And neem oil, I would not necessarily use that unless you have an actual diagnosis of some sort of disease, and it would most likely be a leaf disease. And I'm not a super big fan of neem oil for disease control, even up for leaf diseases. I don't necessarily think they work the best for disease control, although some people swear by them. But my experience with them has been you get marginal control. And again, I'd prefer that you only apply materials if you actually have a diagnosis and know exactly what you're dealing with. And typically, if you get the diagnosis, you're going to be waiting until the next growing season to make applications, because any sort of fungicide, any sort of chemical treatment that you're making for diseases, they help prevent infections. They do not cure existing infections. So applying something after you see symptoms really doesn't do you much good. It's kind of a waste of time and money and
money.
Product.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so definitely get an appropriate diagnosis for what the disease is. Get a sense of whether you really need to be spraying for that particular disease, because lots of times you can get good control by doing cultural things like good fall cleanup, and maybe pruning some in the tree or shrub to get better airflow, or if you're planting a new garden, proper plant spacing. All of those things can impact whether or not you have diseases.
Lori in Madison, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi, we have a bald cypress tree in our yard that we put in. This is, I think, the fourth summer. It was fairly large burlap ball. And it had lovely, lush growth this year. Must have been great conditions. Well, the rains in the past week or so and winds, the branches have sort of drooped down, bent down almost like a willow tree, nearly to the ground. They haven't broken, but they've sort of flopped down with, I think, the weight of the water on the fronds. And so we're wondering if we should tie the branches up. Will it recover? What might we do?
Yeah, oftentimes if you have some sort of weighting issue, so something's weighting the branches down, once those weights dissipate, we normally see this in the wintertime when we get a lot of snow.
Yeah.
And the big plant where I see this on is arborvitae. And typically if that, whatever's weighing the branches down goes away relatively quickly, the branches will recover and they'll bend back up and you'll get back to the shape of the tree that you had before you had that weight. You could potentially try and put some string or some other cording. I would use something that's very soft. I think some of the better material to use is if you have old things like pantyhose or something that's of that sort of consistency that's not real abrasive. You can use that to kind of tie up the branches and that will help them recover. Keep in mind, again, that you don't want something that's really abrasive because you are going to have wind. And if it's an abrasive substance, you can actually end up with physical damage to the bark on the branches. So you need to be careful if you want to do that. But I would be inclined at this point to kind of let things go, just watch it. If you don't see the branches recovering in the next couple of weeks, then you might want to consider trying to tie things out, tie things up, but do be careful when you do that.
Lori, thank you for calling. Let's go to Dennis in Two Rivers next. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. Hey, Brian, if I understood correctly, you talked before about a disease that makes a plant more attractive to it. So I was thinking, well, if there's disease, if there are diseases that are attractive to plant, to invaders like insects or animals, the thing is people need to know first about that disease to treat that so it doesn't just keep cropping up and attracting the predators again. Would that be accurate?
There are certain diseases where we see oftentimes there are diseases where there are insects involved that will move the pathogen around. And so, yes, certainly if you get the disease under control, then you don't get this transmission by the insect. The one that comes to mind that I've been seeing a lot of cases of here recently is a disease called fire blight. It's a bacterial disease that we see on crab apples and pears. And when a tree is infected, oftentimes the bacterium will cause cracks in the bark and will ooze out with sap onto the surface of the branches. And that tends to be attractive to pollinators, particularly honeybees, that will come and feed on that ooze that's coming out of the branches. They'll pick up the bacterium on their bodies. And then as they move around and pollinate, they actually drop off the bacterium in the flowers and the bacterium infects through the flowers. So if you can prune out those infected branches and get rid of them so you don't have that oozy material, that can really reduce the amount of spread of that particular disease-causing organism and cut back on the amount of fire blight that you're seeing. There are other types of diseases that are where the pathogens are insect transmitted. A lot of viruses can be moved around by insects. So if you have any plant that looks like it has virus symptoms, so that would include kind of blotchy colored leaves or leaves that are curled or cupped or distorted or kind of bubbly looking, those can indicate virus diseases. I would be inclined to remove those plants and get rid of them so that if it is an insect transmitted virus, those insects can't visit those plants, pick up the virus and move it around. And the other disease that I worry a little bit about this year, because we had a fair amount of it last year and it can carry over in perennials, is aster yellows. Your previous guest talked about purple coneflower, which I agree is just a wonderful, wonderful plant, but it's quite prone to this disease called aster yellows. The pathogen is what's called a phytoplasma, and it's a bacterium-like organism. It tends to be moved around by leafhoppers. In the case of aster yellows, by the aster leafhopper. And those insects have kind of mouth parts like straws, and they'll insert it into the food conducting tissue inside the plant. And as they're sucking out sap, they're dropping off these phytoplasmas. And they cause the bizarre symptoms. So leaf growth distortions, yellowing of foliage. On purple coneflower, you'll get these green leafy flowers, oftentimes with a little bouquet of secondary flowers that'll pop up off the cone. And those plants are permanently infected, so you want to get rid of them so that as you have leafhoppers come into your yard, they don't acquire that organism and then move around to other plants. So definitely trying to keep the diseases under control for some diseases, particularly if they're moved around by insects, that can be very critical.
Kurt in Sister Bay, it's your turn. Kurt, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks. Great to talk to both of you, and great timing for me. I have about 13 acres of land, primarily white pines, but I'm having an issue with my red pines. They're about 30 feet tall, and one they're dying branch by branch, scattered around the tree, and started last fall, and now some of them have died completely, but others are starting to have the same issue.
Yeah.
I've looked at the needles. I've looked at the bark. I can't see any insects. I haven't seen any anything unusual.
Sure. Yeah, what I would suggest would be to get a sample of some of those dead and dying branches into my clinic for a confirmative diagnosis. But my first thought of what you're dealing with is a disease called diplodia shoot blight. It's a fungal disease, tends to be, red pine is a good host. We see it a lot in urban settings on Austrian pine. That's probably the most problematic pine species where I see this. The fungus tends to infect through the needles, through the shoots. And one of the things I oftentimes look for kind of as a diagnostic tool is if you look at the needles at the tips of the branches, do you see needles that are of different lengths? And if you do, that's another kind of clue that you're dealing with this disease, because the fungus comes in, it'll kill a part of the growing point, the shoot of the branch, and those needles will die first. So they'll be shorter, and then others at the tip will be able to grow a little bit longer before they're killed off. The other thing to look for with this disease is a lot of sap production on the infected branches. So if you're seeing masses of sap, that's another indicator. But the reason you said you were looking very carefully for things, the reason why you're not seeing anything if it is this disease is that what you have to look for is microscopic. So what I'm gonna look for if you send me a sample is little tiny reproductive structures of the fungus. And then inside those are little itty bitty brown spores that are very diagnostic of the disease. So if you're dealing with that, again, it's really, in a forested area, it's difficult to manage because usually I'm dealing with individual trees where my recommendation will be to prune out the diseased branches. And then if you want to follow up with some fungicide treatments, once you've done that pruning, then that can oftentimes help. In a more forested setting, you're probably not going to want to do the fungicide treatments. You're probably not going to be able to do the pruning very easily. So kind of your option is to look at that stand and see whether you can thin it at all. If you thin, you typically get better airflow. You will tend to get more rapid drying of the needles on the plants, which will tend to reduce the number of infections that you will see. The timing of you seeing this is kind of interesting and consistent with what's known about the disease, in that we had that drought back in 2023. And this fungus is around all the time. It does require some wetness on the needles to infect, but once it gets into the tree, if you put trees under stress, particularly drought stress, the fungus tends to be more aggressive and tends to colonize the trees more rapidly than if you have an infected tree that's getting a lot of water and isn't under stress. So it's going to be a challenge to manage that disease in a forested setting. You may just have to let it go its course and take out the trees. You'll get some natural thinning that way, and hopefully at least a fair proportion of the trees will survive and may have a little bit of the disease, but will not get killed off.
All right, Kurt, thank you very much for calling. Brian Huddleston, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. For those insect questions that have been coming up, I should mention that P.J. Leash will be back on the show on Wednesday, July 16th. So a couple of weeks off, but P.J. will be back on July 16th. Right now, as we look at plant diseases with Brian Huddleston, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Terry in Rome, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon, Larry and Brian. I've got several maple trees on my property, the Blaze Maple, that range between 12 and 20 feet high. And the lower leaves seem to be developing like a raised pimple. They're kind of a reddish pimple on the leaves that turn darker as they continue to progress. What am I dealing with and how to get rid of it?
Yeah, I'm glad I listened to PJ talk, you know, on occasion, because so many of the questions today have been insect questions that I at least have a basic knowledge of. Those are what you're probably seeing are insect galls. There are certain types of insects that will lay their eggs in on maple leaves. Oaks actually are a great host for all kinds of different insect galls on the leaves. But there are some of these galls that will form on maple trees. They tend to be kind of pink in color, as you described. They're really a cosmetic issue, so there's nothing you need to do about them. They really don't cause any damage to the trees. And you may see these some years, you may see them, not see them other years. So just kind of try to learn to ignore them. They're not going to cause a significant problem to the tree.
Terry, thank you. Barb in Milwaukee will go to you now. Hi, Barb.
I have a queen And this year, many of the leaves are being misformed. They're kind of folding on themselves and crinkling up. And I notice a slight gray discoloration. I'm wondering if there's anything I can do about that.
It's Queen of the Prairie. We had a little trouble with you hearing it at first, but Queen of the Prairie.
Are they looking kind of grayish in color? Did you say that?
Yes.
Yes. I'm wondering if you may be having a problem with powdery mildew. Queen of the Prairie is a great host for that particular fungal disease, and it can cause relatively severe problems. And you get this fungal growth along the surface of the leaf. It'll often be whitish to grayish in color. It could potentially cause some leaf growth distortions as well, depending upon when the infections have occurred. Not much you can do about it at this point in the season, other than once the plants die back in the fall, I would attempt to remove that leaf debris. That's where the fungus hangs out over the winter. Although that won't totally take care of the problem, because the other place where powdery mildew fungi can hang out is in the overwintering buds for next year's growth. It will really vary from year to year how much powdery mildew you will typically see, although our summer weather in Wisconsin tends to be pretty good for powdery mildew because we have relatively dry conditions and it gets really muggy. That's what powdery mildew fungi really, really like. They don't like a lot of rain, but when we get into midsummer where our rains kind of stall out and it gets our typical Wisconsin muggy July weather, these fungi will be active and doing their thing. If this is a really important plant to you, there is a kind of a home remedy. It's actually based on some research out of Cornell University that you could use as a preventative treatment. You wouldn't apply it now. You'd start applying it to the plant next year when it's still healthy looking. And it's a combination of a tablespoon and a half of baking soda and 3 tablespoons of a lightweight horticultural oil mixed in a gallon of water. And lightweight horticultural oils, those tend to be the ones that are paraffin-based oils. If you kind of want to go super organic with this and use a kitchen oil, I would suggest trying canola oil, because there's some research that indicates that canola oil on its own has some anti-powdery mildew properties. And again, you spray the plants before you see symptoms. That's very, very important. Again, fungicides are not curative. They help prevent infections. They don't cure existing infections. It's also very critical that you get good, even coverage on the leaves, so upper surface, lower surface, to get good control. And you would probably have to go out and apply this product about every 7 to 10 days through the growing season to keep the plants looking relatively healthy. It's a fairly low-impact treatment, relatively easy to mix up and apply. You could put it in like a spritz bottle.
Yeah.
And spritz it on the plant. So it's one of the few fungicide treatments that I kind of will routinely recommend to folks if you have one or two plants that you really want to want to protect from powdery mildews.
Yeah. Barb, thank you for calling. Perry in Oconto, your turn now. Hi, Perry.
Yes. I have a question about trimming tree branches. Now, I know it's probably like the worst time of the year to do it, but if you're forced to, maybe a branch you neglected to trim is now reaching out into the sidewalk or something. Anything you can do to be better health for the tree? Is there a weather pattern or anything that helps, or you just take chances?
Yeah, in general, I recommend doing pruning in the wintertime when disease-causing organisms are active. If you're absolutely desperate to prune off a branch, then I would definitely wait until we have a period where there are going to be several days where it's really warm and dry. You really don't want to prune when there's a lot of moisture around, because that cut wound that you've made on the tree by pruning is a potential entry point for disease-causing organisms, particularly wood rot organisms that you really don't want established in your trees. So you want a long enough period for that wound that you've created to kind of naturally dry out, and then that drier surface will not be a great environment for disease-causing organisms. In general, we don't recommend using pruning paints when you prune. The exception is with oak trees. I really suggest only pruning oaks in the wintertime, but if you're absolutely desperate and need to cut off a branch for some reason during the growing season, have a can of paint right next to you as you make that pruning cut and paint over that wound. We really worry about with oaks, about oak wilt. It's a fungal disease, and that particular pathogen is moved around by sap beetles, and they can be attracted to wounds on oak trees very, very quickly. There's some research that indicates within about 10 minutes you can have sap beetles visit a prune on an oak tree. So you need to have that paint there as a physical barrier to basically make that wound not attractive to the sap beetles, and that'll help prevent transmission of this oak wilt fungus. But definitely, if you're interested in pruning a tree branch, I suggest you go to the UW Extension horticulture website. There's a nice fact sheet there on pruning deciduous trees, and it tells you exactly how to do that. There's a three-point cut technique that you can use to minimize any damage that you might do to the tree by pruning off the branch, and follow those instructions. But again, do it when it's dry, if you have to do it now.
Perry, thank you. Luann in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Luann.
Hi. I have two questions, if that's all right.
We'll see if we can get you in.
Okay. I have a small peach tree that has red spots on the leaves. What can I do?
Yeah, that's the peach leaf curl disease that we talked about earlier. And my recommendation, since we talked about that earlier, would be visit my clinic website and just look up the UW Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic and search in the main menu on the left side of the main page for our fact sheet series, and look up the fact sheet on peach leaf curl. Take a look at that. And then if you have questions after you've read that, my email is on there. You're welcome to give me an email shout, and we can talk a little bit more about that disease. And your second question?
My second question is, my raspberries have not bared fruit for a couple of years. And they're older. They're not real old plants, but they're mature plants. Could they be too close to the cedar trees?
I don't know that unless you're getting a lot of shading. Sometimes the issue with raspberries not fruiting can be they need to be pruned routinely. And so for information on that, I would go to do a search on the UW Extension Learning Store. And there's a really wonderful publication there called Growing Raspberries in Wisconsin that'll talk about how to grow plants, prune raspberries, so that you can get good fruit. From a disease standpoint, one of the issues that we see with raspberries, as they have been in the ground for an extended period of time, they tend to get infected with a variety of different types of viruses. And as that viral load builds up, then they tend to stop producing really good fruit. The fruit you'll get lesser numbers of fruit, and then also the fruit that you do get really crumbly. So that could be a contributing factor as well.
Luann, thank you. And then in 30 seconds or so, Bill in Oregon has his milkweed early and abundant on the property, but the stems are wilting from the top down. Doesn't see aphids or insects.
Yeah, hard to predict on that one. I need to see a sample. It could be a root issue of some kind. I've never seen verticillium wilt in milkweed, but I can't rule that out. That's a disease I talked about earlier. That fungus tends to have a wide host range. I've not seen it on that host, but I can't rule that out. But I would think possibly some sort of, from a disease standpoint, some sort of root issue of some kind.
Yeah, that makes sense. And on that note, Brian, thank you so much for coming
by.
We'll do it again.
Okay, sounds good.
In the meantime, appreciate it very much. Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. And thank you so much for listening in. We had a great team of people who put our shows on every day. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers. Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. With us as well, as technical directors, our executive producer, Jill Nadol. I'm Larry Mueller. I hope you have a great weekend. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.